Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to another edition of Life Behind Bars. I'm Noah Rothbaum, the Daily Beast Half Full Editor. Joining me, as always, is my colleague and co-host, David Weinchurch. How are you, Dave?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm okay. Our conversation a couple of weeks ago about all of the bars that we wish we could visit, and hopefully we will someday soon.
Yeah.
Really, I think, you know, got us thinking about other bars that, you know, we wish we could visit now.
I mean, as long as we're wishing, we might as well wish big, right?
Exactly. And by that, I think, you know, through the course of reading and writing and talking there, each one of us has a list in the back of our minds of all these amazing bars that are sadly no longer with us. Some of them closed, I don't know, at least on my list, you know, decades ago or maybe
even centuries.
Yeah, so that you and I have been keeping track of in the back of our heads. I'm not sure why, but, you know, I guess maybe when we can't sleep, we add to these lists. But there's definitely a number of historic and important and some not so important bars. But
well, at this point, I'll go to just about any bar. But
fair enough. Well, I have an inkling. I knew that you would want to go to McSorley's first. For the bars, once bars open up back in New York, I'm sure you will make a beeline right there. I have a pretty good idea of what bar, if you could visit any bar that exists in history, you would go to. So I'll let you take the first one.
I'll go along with your inkling and give you the one that I think you're looking for here is Jerry Thomas Bar.
Exactly.
Jerry Thomas, great American, born in 1830. Sailor, artist, no less, writer in some way. You know, he did write the first Bartender's Guide. Sporting life character, saw 22 bare knuckle boxing matches, all that kind of stuff. And his most famous bar was 22nd Street in Broadway, New York. It ran from around 1868 until 1873, and then it moved uptown a little bit. I would love to go look at that bar. I mean, I know I would know my way around. I've read enough descriptions of it. You go through the door, the tables are on your right where you get grilled meats, steaks, chops, that kind of thing, oysters, big long bar at your left. It ran through the block between Broadway and Fifth Avenue. So there was always a back entrance in case somebody was coming in the front that you didn't want to see. That's always important in a bar, I think.
Is that the block that today, like the Flatiron Building is on? Or is
Flatiron
it like,
Building is one block up.
One block up from that. Got it.
This building still stands.
Amazing.
So this is, of all the places he attended bar, this is the one that still stands. And, you know, I would love to put a bar in there someday. But, you know, just to sit there at the bar and watch Jerry Thomas, who was a raconteur par excellence and gathered a very sporty crew of people, to watch all these people going back and forth and bullshitting with each other and drinking just perfectly made little cocktails. That just would be an incredible pleasure. My God, history in the making.
There's going to be that Jerry Thomas bar, perhaps one in San Francisco. So I had a follow-up bar for both.
Okay.
Just in case. Well,
what have you got?
Well, I was thinking like, you know, if it was one of Jerry Thomas's bars in San Francisco, we could go to William Cocktail Boothby, you know, one of his bars. There's obviously another
great
American bartender who wrote his own, you know, couple of cocktail books around the turn of the century. You know, since we started out in New York, I thought, you know, look, we're right there, right? So go a couple blocks north, right? And we'd be at the Hoffman House, right? Which is...
Oh, nice. You beat me to it.
I knew. Well, I set you up for it. It's an assist. The Hoffman House was what? It was on Madison Square Park, just a few blocks up. It was the grandest, you know, most regal, hotel of the time, you know, with a loyal and well-heeled following and clientele, and the bar obviously was legendary.
Maybe the greatest bar New York City has ever seen, which is saying something. Everybody kind of held it in that regard at the time. I think it closed in 1915. We got to get that time machine cranked up pretty good for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these kind of places where, I mean, everything was lavish, you know, from the art behind the bars, you know, famous painting that I think is now at the Williams College collection, you know, to all of the bartenders who come through the Hoffman House and, you know, learn and, you know, that, you know, spread the knowledge really all around the world and kind of helped, you know, build, you know, what we know today as, you know, a cocktail bar.
They were big champions of like sort of the latest trends in mixology at the time. So you see early on, they were doing vermouth cocktails and, you know, martinis and Manhattans when they were new and all that kind of stuff. And it was always the place to go. And also, you know, you could get a $5 glass of brandy there. Nothing cost $5 in an American bar, right, except there.
Because
it would be like, you know, 180-year-old brandy from their cellars. So that's pretty impressive.
That's pretty good.
I'll go with a guy who supposedly worked for Jerry Thomas.
Okay.
Briefly, or at least knew him in New York. And then he was an Italian, Ciro Capozzi, born outside of Naples in the Bay of Naples. Father was a sea captain. He travels around. He goes maybe to San Francisco, to New York, works for Jerry Thomas, maybe for Delmonico's in the early 1880s, and then goes to the French Riviera and ends up a bartender at a little tiny bar in Monte Carlo, which had a casino. And it was, you know, this new place where every top hat and an expensive gown in the world was seen parading for about 3 months out of the year, from January through March. And Ciro, he starts tending bar there, American style. He always told people, when it comes to drinks, I'm an American. And making just perfect New York City style cocktails, including Manhattans and martinis, which were new in Europe. Nobody really, you know, knew much about those. And he's so charming and so good at his job that he gets the Prince of Wales as one of his clients, and it goes on from there. And he ends up with this, not only a bar, but a restaurant, the fanciest in Monte Carlo. Eventually, in like 1911, he finally retires, sells out, and those people open Ciro's in Paris and London and the French resort Deauville and all over. And it's like the greatest luxury chain. But it starts with a guy just tending bar in New York City, you know, like everybody else, which I think is great. Yeah, it was just a bartender, but he was a smart one. And like Delmonico's, I suspect he did work there because he learned how to serve the best of everything in a bar and a restaurant and to make people happy with that. So that would be my number two, just because I think it would be very cool to gawp at all the royalty and all that.
Oh, yeah. Since we're already on that side of the ocean, I think if you were there, you'd have to go, and I'd want to go to see Ada Coleman at the Savoy Hotel.
Oh, yeah.
Famous for, obviously, the Hanky Panky was her signature cocktail. Unfortunately, the legacy of the bartender who followed her, a man named Harry Craddock, who obviously wrote the Savoy cocktail book, has cast a very big shadow. And, you know, Ada's, you know, legacy, you know, is in sort of written out of history, which is really unfortunate.
He kind of got her fired, which I hold against him.
I had our colleague Wynn Curtis once go down the rabbit hole, like looking to find out exactly what happened, because some people say that Ada mentored, you know, Harry Craddock, which is, you know, perhaps the most optimistic view of what happened.
Yeah, no, that didn't happen.
You know, others say that, you know, Harry Craddock had her pushed out, and then she worked. I mean, she definitely worked in the florist shop of the Savoy Hotel after being a bartender there, which doesn't seem to be her choice.
You know, she left and worked at Romano's, which was very fancy.
Yeah.
In London. And Romano's was was kind of like Ciro's. It was, you know, it was a place where all the fancy people went. And so she had a little bit of an after career. Craddock came, and he was working at the grill room at the Savoy, not the American bar. You know, he was tending bar at the grill room, and all the Americans liked him. And he used that as lobbying. The Americans were uncomfortable having a woman bartender. the American tourists who were coming over, and it was prohibition, so there were lots of American tourists coming over and wanting to drink. You know, partly they were uncomfortable because they liked to curse and carry on and you know, be bros, basically, and they thought that she was kind of, you know, judging them. Craddock kind of was able to use that to get her moved on, her and her fellow barmaid there, Kitty Burgess. Who knows?
Yeah.
To have been at her bar would have been amazing.
Yeah. You know, we know some of the drinks that she made, but to like see her in action and talk to her, I mean, I think that would be incredible.
She was evidently, you know, incredibly charming and was much beloved by her local clientele. And so I'm sure it would have been just an absolute joy and a delight to have her mix you a drink, a hanky panky or whatever. Well, as long as we're in London, I'm going to go back a little bit.
Yeah, please.
I want to go back to 1731 to James Ashley's Punch House, Ludgate Hill.
Well, we said there were bars from centuries ago that we wanted to go.
We weren't kidding. This guy is, I'm convinced it's to him and his staff that we owe modern bartending, because he did something, you know, punch was the name of the game, and you'd buy a bowl of punch in London, and a bowl of punch was expensive at the time. And he opened his London Punch House in 1731. He lowered the price by a quarter, which is already good. And that was for a big, you know, for a bowl of punch where you'd use a quart of spirits in there. And he figured out a way that he would, or not he as much as his staff, who were women, bartending in England was always the actual mixing drinks and work manning, as we say, inappropriately manning the bar, was actually, you were actually womaning the bar there. The women would go to the customer and they'd bring a spirit measure, like a 1 quart measure with the brandy or whatever, the rum, Batavia, Arak, whatever they were going to make the punch from. Those are the three spirits that they stock. And you would get to taste it in the thing, so you'd see that you were getting a quality spirit. And then they'd mix it with the juice and water and spices and sugar all at your table side. And fresh orange peels would be peeled and put in there. And once the bowl was done, they'd hang the peels up on the ceiling, which would have been, so if you walked in, the whole ceiling was just row of dried orange peel up there, commemorating the bowls of punch that were served.
That's incredible.
What he did that was exceptional also is he not only served large bowls, he served any quantity down to the size of a cup. So you could step to the bar and for very little money, one of the bartenders would mix you a cup of punch to order. And that's, as far as I can tell, that's bartending, right? Just like we have now, and they're mixing you a glass and handing it to you.
Absolutely.
And so his punch house went for a very long time. It was very popular. He lived to a ripe old age. He was one of those people who liked to sue people. That was his chief recreation. So he kept suing people his whole life. I think he was probably a bit of a miserable son of a bitch, but whatever. He lived a long time and kept the place going, and it lasted up until about the 1830s, so 100 years for the London Punch House. And it had two huge iron punch bowls on a stand out front so that people knew where to go, because many people couldn't read originally. So they'd go to the sign of the two punch bowls. And I would love to go between those punch bowls.
Take a selfie.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have anything quite as old as on my list, but probably visit.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mr. Tom Bullock.
Oh, hell yeah.
You know, who wrote The Ideal Bartender book, which is the first cocktail book written by a black man in America. You know, who Tens Bar at a number of country clubs, right, in St. Louis, and then the Pendennis Club in Louisville. But, you know, try to go visit him at one of his establishments on our forget Bill and Ted's Noah and Dave's Excellent Adventure back through history. It would be great to stop at one of his bars and get him to make us some drinks.
Absolutely. I mean, as long as we're down south like that, or in, you know, the southern context, I would also want to go to Richmond to the bar that John Dabney owned after the Civil War.
Oh,
John
yeah.
Dabney, who was able to purchase his freedom by working behind the bar, and was the legendary maker of mint juleps. And just to have one of John Dabney's juleps would have been such a pleasure. You know, he made juleps for the Prince of Wales when he came to Richmond. He and his partner Jim Cook. So it would be fantastic. But you know, that's on the other hand, the other clientele in the bar might not be so great. You never know.
Right.
Some of those people bother me. But
to be honest, we could play this game
for
hours, days on end. You know, I would say other bars before 50 on 1950, or actually, was it 1850 for you too, but 1950 for me. I would also say probably Harry's New York Bar in Paris, you know, with all of those amazing barflies and all the characters who posted up at those bars would be pretty awesome to hang out there and have a
few. I mean, to catch it at its height in the 20s would be fantastic.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And then for you, any others before we enter the modern age? Or I mean, there's so many,
but the one that really jumps out is the Bank Exchange in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
Where Tom Nichol, once Tom Nichol took over, the Bank Exchange was one of the older bars in San Francisco, you know, built in 1853 in this new building on the site of an older bank exchange. But it was a very fancy bar, you know, big mahogany bar that came around Cape Horn, around the bottom of South America and went all the way up there. Black and white marble checkered floor, that all that kind of stuff. But Duncan Nichol was a Scotsman and a sailor who jumped ship in San Francisco, like many bartenders did. Jerry Thomas and Harry Johnson as well, all jumped ship in San Francisco, which is kind of funny. So he jumps ship there, and then he tends bar, and he ends up buying the Bank Exchange in around 1890. And his specialty was Pisco Punch. And he made this absolutely delightful Pisco Punch. And by the early 1900s, it survived the fire. And his place had become kind of like a museum and debating club, and women were allowed to drink there. It was so genteel. He was, you know, he kept a tight ship. He wanted everybody to behave. He kept track of how much you drank, and if you started to get drunk, out you went. If you were pleasantly tipsy and you know could maintain a polite and amusing conversation, you could stay. And I would just love to see that atmosphere and that being that piece of California history.
So, I mean, San Francisco, it sort of becomes a city when that, you know, goes from, you know, you wrote a piece for Half Full a couple of years ago, centuries ago, who knows? I'd say a couple of years ago.
They all blur together now.
Whatever. I mean, it's a blip on the map when we're talking about bars from 1700s. About, you know, San Francisco going basically from a place where they're not even paved sidewalks and roads to, you know, a city, you know, and so much of that identity is wrapped around its bars. And
the Bank Exchange was in the Montgomery block, which they built to be proof to earthquakes and fire in 1853. And it was built by this guy, Halleck, General Halleck, who was a military engineer. And when they finally demolished it, sadly, in the early 60s, 1960s, the Transamerica Pyramid is there now. But when they demolished it, it took them more than a week to tear it down, this building, because it was just so strongly built. It was indestructible.
Wow.
You know, the monkey block, they called it, the Montgomery block. But I wish they had kept it.
We play a little speed round for the modern era, since unfortunately there are quite a few bars, even in the last, I'd say, 40 years that I would like to be at that don't exist anymore. I mean, these two, I think, kind of go hand in hand. Our buddy Gary Regan down at the North Star Pub, you know, on South Street Seaport in New York, when it used to be a seaport.
Yeah.
Well, there actually was a seaport and fish you know, fish market was there, not a tourist attraction, but Gary, you know, was one of his, you know, big, you know, bar postings, you know, where he, you know, had a ton of whiskey and, you know, I guess one of the first bars really to carry that kind of selection of single malt in America. So and just to see Gary in his prime, I have to say, with the full beard and not holding back and, you know, just to get a few more minutes, a few more hours with Gary would be amazing.
Well, I'll jump back even to catch him at Drake's Drum when he first came to New York.
Oh,
he was
yeah.
a mere slip of a lad. He was a 21.
I'm not sure I could have handled him.
It was then, the early 70s in New York were pretty wild, from what I heard from my friends' older brothers and sisters. But you know, he was there for a while, and you know, I overlapped a little bit, but I never went up there. But I would have loved to catch him at Drake's Drum. It was a lively place. You listen to Gary's stories about it.
Yeah. Oh, I can only imagine. And then, you know, right around the same time, like to see Dale DeGroff, you know, at the Rainbow Room in his prime, you know, behind his bar in his red jacket, snapping cocktails, shaking them in tune to the band leader and, you know, the band there playing songs and, you know, entertaining a crowd of regulars and tourists and all the folks at the Rainbow Room who came there, which, I mean, at the time was, you know, one of the pinnacles of fine dining in America.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, it was quite a, literally and figuratively, quite a stage for him to practice his art of cocktail. So I got to see Dale later at Blackbird, but never at the Rainbow Room, although I think I ate there as a kid.
I saw him once at the Rainbow Room, but we didn't sit at the bar. We sat at a table and enjoyed the nice view and drank some of the porcelains. And I saw him back there, you know, looking very impressive. I've got one more from back in the day from my New York. I used to be in the house band at Club 57 on St. Mark's Place, which was a social club for the East Village that had a beat up little tiny bar. And I would love to have one of their crappy gin and tonics made with rail gin and flat tonic and maybe one ice cube, just to take in the scene in 79, 80 and see the wildness again of the East Village. I used to just shut up and play my bass and just gawp at the goings on there. And they were quite extreme. That would be a little bit of nostalgia.
Jumping a little bit ahead to December 31st, 1999, to the Lower East Side, which still looked pretty rough, to opening night for Milk and Honey, for Sasha Petrovsky's bar, to be there on, I don't know who was there on December 31st, that may be his mother.
I think probably four of Sasha's friends.
I was going to say, right, his mother, some of his friends. I mean, I don't know who was there, but it would be pretty amazing to have been there on opening night for Milk and Honey. Obviously, Sasha goes on to open up a slew of other bars, Little Branch, Middle Branch, Attaboy is now where Milk and Honey was, but I mean, run by, you know, all of his disciples and bartenders he trained and the bartenders that they trained, you know, the Varnish.
I mean, it's such a family.
California with Eric Alpern. So, I mean, it's a huge family, and it all starts with this one tiny bar in a tenement building on the Lower East Side.
Behind a tailor shop.
Yeah, in the middle of nowhere, you know. So I don't know who would have found their way in there on December 31st, 1999, when we all thought the world was going to end when it went to 2000, like the Prince song. But December 31st, 1999, to spend one night in Milk and Honey, that first night with Sasha, would have been an incredible thing to say. I mean, I think that, and to really be part of history.
Also from back in the day is Mickey's, which was a bar in what's now Tribeca, very, very fancy residential district in Lower Manhattan. Then it was an empty commercial loft district that very few people lived in. And Mickey's was the last building standing on its block. It was a corner bar, and it was surrounded by a parking lot on three sides. And I was going to New York University at the time. We're talking like 1980. And living at the Bellevue School of Nursing, which was NYU rented out spaces from, dorm space, which was full of nursing students. And we used to pile in, one of the guys had a car, and we'd pile in the car with as many of us as we could fit from the dorm and go down to Mickey's, which was just a little dive bar, but it had a jukebox with soul music on it and old rock and roll, and a dance floor that was about 6 feet square. Now, dancing was illegal in New York City bars, but the cops never came by. Right. So you'd put a dollar or 50 cents or whatever in the jukebox, and they had it playing very loud, and then everybody would dive onto the dance floor and writhe up against each other, and it was highly fun. You know, it was only for young people. But it was, it was
like a good night.
It was, those are some of my favorite memories of New York, of just the hoot of it all. And, that's definitely an older New York.
The last two bars on my list, I have to say, caused me great pain because, I mean, it's one thing to talk about bars that, you know, right, opened and closed, you know, decades before we were born, but, you know, I would love to go back to Cooley Reiner's bar on 19th Street, yeah, the Flatiron Lounge. So many good nights there. I mean, that was my regular. I mean, even though I live miles away, yeah, that's how much I loved it. And then what also pains me so much to say is our beloved Pegu Club on Houston, which just closed.
It was on my list too.
Yeah, I had a feeling, yeah, it might be. And I, you know, it's one of these things I can't even believe it's gone since we've all been sheltering at home.
You know, that was the first like new style, like craft cocktail bar I saw that worked on a large scale. It was proof of concept that it didn't have to be a little tiny speakeasy bar where you did this. You could have a real like, yeah, elegant hotel type bar. I mean, it wasn't in a hotel, but it might as well have been, where all were welcome. Yeah. Where there was plenty of space.
It was transportive. Yeah,
where they had table service, yeah, you know, and where the cocktails, yeah, were perfect.
I think we'll be feeling that one for a while, the loss of that one. And once we're allowed to meet up for cocktails again in person, I hope to toast Pegu and all these other bars that no longer are with us, but we'd love to visit. Obviously, if we missed any, we've only missed probably several thousand other ones that we could have mentioned. Please let us know on Twitter or write us a note. Dave and I would love to hear about the bars that you're.
Well, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll do episode 3.
You know what? Or 17. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean,
I think there's
life behind closed bars.
To keeping open all the bars that we know and love now.
I'll drink to that. Amen. Cheers.
Cheers. Dave and I encourage you to drink responsibly always.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.